This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Matthew Quick has always believed in the power of a good book. As an English teacher in Philadelphia, he reveled in pairing a student with the right novel. Eventually, the pen came calling for Matthew. He quit teaching, started writing, and became a best-selling novelist with The Silver Linings Playbook. His latest novel features a high school girl named Nanette, who's transformed after reading a book. Matthew Quick's novel is called Every Exquisite Thing. He reads tonight at Flyleaf Books at Chapel Hill and Saturday at Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville. But first, Matthew Quick joins me on The State of Things. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
This book, I understand, reflects a lot of your own experiences, particularly your earlier career as a teacher. Am I right?
Yeah, I would say it reflects kind of my personal journey, you know, as a reader, as a teenager, as a teacher, and also as an author. You know, we have Nanette in the book, who is obviously a teenager, and then we have Booker, who's the author, and there's also a teacher in there as well. So,
well, start with Nanette. Tell us more about her.
She is a young woman who, for her whole life, has been the good girl. You know, she's done everything that she's supposed to do. She's privileged, and she knows it, and she is a star soccer player. She has everything that she's supposed to want, and yet she's deeply miserable. And she wants to do things that she's not supposed to do. And she wants to take control of her life in a way that is often frowned upon in upper-class suburban America.
And particularly when it would mean turning your back on those things that you've already been recognized, right?
Yeah, and I worked in a high school outside of Philadelphia where that was, you know, I hesitate to say this, but that was the lie that we were selling, that if you got the top SAT score, if you won the Colonial Conference and sports team, right, you know, your life is going to be perfect afterwards. And that's not necessarily true. You know, those things can lead to wonderful opportunities, but for some people, there are different paths.
This is where Nanette's English teacher comes in, recognizing some of the symptoms, right?
Yeah, and he sees it quite clearly because he's the type of person that doesn't follow that path. You know, he's not a herd member either. And so he puts this book called The Bubblegum Reaper in her hands, which is largely about nonconformity and questioning society and, you know, stepping away from the herd. And it's mind-blowing for her because she's never had someone tell her that was possible or that other people were doing this before. And I saw this again and again with the teenagers that I worked with, that, you know, they were given just this one-party line, and a book could really be so incredibly moving to them because for the first time an adult was telling them something that they never heard before.
Well, and this is when you, in your real life as a teacher, began to recognize not only the lie that we're sort of passing on, just conform and you'll be fine, but also, you know, our complicity in it and the difference between education, which is really opening the mind of a child, you know, and training, which is getting them ready to be a good consumer. You ran into some of this. You ran afoul of the system when you introduced Invisible Man in the syllabus, right? Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is a very shocking moment in my young teaching career. I added Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, which is a fantastic novel by anyone's standards. And I added it because I was teaching in a very privileged, almost exclusively white school. And it was shocking. You know, my students had never experienced anything like that. And one of the parents came to me privately and accused me of adding it because there was some type of pressure to, you know, add a book because of African-American History Month. And it dawned on me as I'm having this conversation that it was very threatening for him to have, you know, this one book by an African-American author in the curriculum. And I said to myself, you know, there is something going on here. You know, there is a kind of unspoken agreement that we're all going to go in this certain direction. And we might not talk about it, but, you know, my adding that book was not only revolutionary, but it was dangerous for my career. And I felt threatened when that parent said that to me.
So now let's get back to Nanette and the impact that Bubblegum Reaper has on her and where she takes it. She's now really anxious to meet the author of this book. This has really moved her.
Yeah, and so her teacher explains that the author is a local, and he's kind of a recluse, and he's kind of also open to speaking to people who are different, who want to go on a different path. And so she has to meet him. She wants this role model, this father figure or this mentor that's going to tell her that it's okay if she quits the soccer team. It's okay if she decides that SATs aren't the most important thing in the world. And so she strikes up this relationship with Booker that in some ways is very liberating for her, but it's also confusing because he won't give her a direct answer. He won't give her the recipe for life, which is what she's so hungry for, because that's what she's been told her whole life, that there is this recipe for success. And what he tells her is you have to think for yourself. And when you break away from the herd, he phrases it, when you leave the cage, everyone else in the cage is going to whack you on the way out and it's going to hurt. But if you get far enough away from the cage, the whacking stops because they're so afraid to leave the cage themselves. And so he basically dares her to break out of this bubble.
And this is the fascinating, to me, the intersection here between fiction and nonfiction, because, you know, part of the propaganda campaign to turn kids into consumers that we do in our education process when it's not working well, when you don't have teachers who care the way you did. And there are certainly a lot of great teachers out there who worry about the minds of their children.
Absolutely.
But the system is stacked against them. And so the idea that fiction would have this transformative effect, because, you know, part of the story is, go be an individual, be yourself, and then we can tell the biographical stories of people like Galileo, who struck out on their own despite all the, you know, odds, and the church was against him. We tell those stories as nonfiction, but they don't have a transformative effect. In fact, they have the opposite effect of making you a more disciplined citizen. Why does fiction work in a way that nonfiction, the stories of these heroes who went their own path, doesn't always work?
I think it's funny because we're so dismissive of fiction as a culture. You know, we want to say, like, it's only a story, it doesn't really matter. And yet when, something threatening or something controversial gets put into the curriculum, everybody rises up in arms. So we kind of tell this narrative that stories don't matter, but the wrong stories do. And I think the reason for that is because most people don't understand how a narrative works on someone's subconscious. I went in as a teacher with a very clear agenda in my mind. I used to have a quote from Kurt Vonnegut, who, you know, I'll summarize the quote. And I had a picture of him. He was holding a baby in my classroom, in the front of the classroom. And underneath it said, you know, people ask me, why do we teach literature when, you know, doctors and lawyers and army commanders don't read novels? And he said, the answer is, we make young people read novels before they become doctors and lawyers and army commanders, and we infect them with humanity. And that was really my mission, to infect people with humanity. And unfortunately, like you were saying before, people who are infected with humanity aren't necessarily good consumers. They don't often vote the way that certain politicians would like them to vote. And so, of course, the schools are going to squash that. We pay a lot of lip service to making, you know, more humane people, more humane citizens. But, I think it's interesting also. I mean, I don't want to get on a soapbox here, but we take more and more time away from reading novels and more time on standardized tests, which is because we're monetizing the school system.
And paying for those tests.
Exactly.
Paying private companies to make them. So would you read for us from your book, and maybe you can set up this section of the novel?
Yeah, so this first reading is when Nanette meets Booker in a coffee shop, and she's talking about Booker's novel, The Bubblegum Reaper, and she's really concerned because she doesn't understand what happens in the end, and she wants to know exactly what happens. So this is Nanette in the first person, speaking to Booker. I went to my third question saying, what happens to Wrigley after he gets out of the creek? Who says he ever gets out? So he drowns? We can't know for sure. Why? The story ends. But you could write more. No, I can't. There's no more to write. Why? Just the way it is. The story ends where it ends. I don't understand. See that nice woman who served us our coffee? I looked back over my shoulder at the tall cashier with the brown ponytail and the permanent smile on her face, and I nodded. Her name is Ruth, Booker said. Ever see her before? Kids my age never came into the coffee shop, so I said no. Maybe you won't ever see her again. So? You only get to see 5 minutes of Ruth's story, and that's just the way it is. But Ruth, well, she goes on now whether you're looking or not. She does all sorts of things that some people see and some don't. But your version of Ruth's story will be the 5 minutes you spent buying coffee from her. That's just the way it is. All right, I said, but what does that have to do with the Bubblegum Reaper? Ruth is real. Wrigley is a fictional character. There are no such things as fictional characters.
That's author Matthew Quick reading from Every Exquisite Thing, and he'll be doing readings around the state. You can check our website, stateofthings.org, to find out where you can see him next. We've been sort of blending fact and fiction and your actual life with this, and I want you to tell us a story, because you had a kind of pivotal moment yourself when you were traveling. I think you were in the Amazon, where you had to come to terms with your own trajectory.
It was at the end of my teaching career, and one of the things that I was doing was I was chaperoning trips to South America. I had done it two times before, and this was the third time. And it was the second time I'd gone to Peru, and our guide was a kind of a ex-hippie American type, and has sort of become a father figure to me since. We had become friendly and stayed in touch since the first trip, and we had put the kids to bed on the boat, and we were having a drink on the Amazon on the deck. And the stars are above, and it was beautiful. And Scott said to me, he said, I want you to know that a lot of your students are saying really great things about you as a teacher. And I said, well, thank you for the compliment, but that's actually not comforting to hear right now. And he said, why? And I said, because I don't want to teach anymore. I want to be a writer, and I feel really guilty about that. And he looked at me and said, so be a writer. And I said, well, I can't, because I'm so good at being a teacher. I got to keep doing this, and I believe in this work, but it's making me miserable, and I'm burned out. And he said to me, I'm just going to say this to you, you know, and just because you're good at something doesn't mean you have to do it. And it was one of these really, like, kind of a light bulb, anti-American, you know, like, idea. Like, in America, if you're good at something, you've got to monetize it and make $1 million and go after it and be the best, number one. And it was the first time in a long time that I realized that, you know, I had a choice, you know, that I could choose to be a writer. It didn't matter that I was doing great work as a teacher. I could leave. That work would still have been done. And now I could go do great work as a writer.
And Nanette confronts Booker with roughly the same way.
Yeah. I mean, there's a scene where he says almost verbatim the same thing to her. You know, she doesn't want to play soccer anymore. And, you know, her parents are saying that, you know, you have a scholarship, you have this gift, you know, you have to pursue it. And he said, you know, just because you're good at something, you don't have to do it. And I coached high school sports, and it's a great experience. But there was always one or two kids on the team, be it basketball or soccer, and they're almost always the best athlete on the team that hated playing. They were the best, but they hated it. And some of them went on to play collegiate, and they hated it through college as well. And I'd ask them, why are you doing this? And say, it's just what I do. My parent. And, you know, you think about how an adult told a six-year-old kid to start dribbling a basketball and then made them do it until they were 22.
Right, and they're constantly reinforced, and this is the way mommy and daddy love you. And so, you know, obviously you keep going, but then there's a big disconnect because your heart not loving you so much.
Yeah, and I remember I had student athletes that were fantastic writers, that fantastic poets, and of course you're not going to say, hey, give up that, you know, Division I scholarship to play basketball so you can write poetry. Like, nobody's going to say that in America, but maybe we should.
So you have written this book, Every Exquisite Thing, and we talked about your previous book, which has become a film.
The Silver Linings Playbook has become a film, yes.
And there's a screenplay on, and in fact, this has been optioned. Your latest book, Every Exquisite Thing, also optioned as well.
Yep, there's a screenplay by Ted Melfi, who did a great movie by the name of St. Vincent with Bill Murray a few years back. And I've read the screenplay. It's absolutely fantastic, and I can't wait to see what he does.
When you have a book as successful as your first book that then becomes a movie, I wonder if, as you're writing your next book, do you start to do the screenplay and the novel begin to merge in your mind?
Well, lucky for me, I published the Silver Linings Playbook in 2008, and the movie didn't come out until 2012. So I had written several novels in between there. But it's interesting, my next book comes out with HarperCollins next year. It's called The Reason You're Alive. And we sold it simultaneously to Miramax, and I'm writing the screenplay for that. And I knew that I wanted to write the screenplay for that book. And so it was interesting as a storyteller to write a novel within the back of your head, realizing that you were not going to sell it to Hollywood unless you were given the permission to write the screenplay yourself. It's a very personal story because it's based on a lot of things my uncle has told me. He's passed away. And I wouldn't say that it necessarily changes it in a bad way. I think it can enhance it, because you can do things on the screen that you can't do on the page and vice versa. And so for me now, writing the screenplay, which I'm doing this summer, I'm taking this book that is very narrative driven, you're inside someone's head, and I'm expanding it so that you can see all the other characters. And it's a way to make you know, round out the story in a way that's accessible both on screen and the page.
I would have to assume that, and correct me if I'm wrong, that screenwriting is different from writing a novel.
Extremely. I think the biggest difference is before I do anything, I've got to have conversations with the director. I have to have a conversation with studio. I have to have conversations with the producer. And so you get a lot of notes and you have a lot of voices in your head. I don't think I could write a novel that way. But with the screenplay, it's very helpful to have a discussion with the director before you start to write. It can save you a lot of time.
But in terms of the content and the structure of the novel, and I would guess this has to be true for every novelist, because if you've come of age in the age of movies and you know you've seen them and you know your readers have seen them, obviously film has an impact on a writer's imagination, right?
Yeah, I've often said that I fell in love with film before I fell in love with books. I didn't come in the neighborhood where I grew up, people weren't reading novels. But everyone was watching movies, of course. And so that's how I learned about storytelling, that and through my church growing up in a very religious household. But novels came along a little bit later in my teen years. And so people say my work is very cinematic. And I think sometimes people mean that as a criticism, and I don't see it that way. You know, I just think that, we're a visual culture.
Novelist Matthew Quick, his latest book is called Every Exquisite Thing. He reads tonight at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill, then Saturday Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us.
It was an absolute pleasure.
You can find out more about Matthew's visits, his readings, and anything else we've talked about at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and Charlie Sheldon Ormond. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wodarski is sitting in today. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.